The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic, tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, welcome to the 7th Seneca Podcast. I'm Jeremy Goldcorn, your host today, taking the place of Kaiser Gore, who is in Australia this week and will be back next week. Today we're going to discuss the recent spate of attacks on schoolchildren across China and also syphilis. To enlighten us on these topics, we have two frequent guests, Gadi Epstein, the Beijing bureau chief of Forbes magazine, and Will Moss, the blogger behind Image Thief. And we're also joined by Qinli Wen, a blogger, columnist, author, and bookstore owner who just today finished writing a column for a Chinese magazine about the school stabbings. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we get going, I'd just like to put a word of thanks to popupchinese.com, who have provided both the hosting for this podcast and the studio in which we are now sitting. But let's get straight on to the crime and violence. I'd like to introduce the topic with Malcolm Moore of the Daily Telegraph, an article by him. Seven children at a nursery school in northwestern China have been hacked to death and at least 20 more injured in the ninth attack involving children in just over a month. The attack is the latest in a series of seemingly copycat knife attacks against young children. The spate of violence began at the end of March when a mentally unstable former doctor murdered eight children at a school in Fujian province. That crime sparked further attacks across the country, mostly involving furiously frustrated middle-aged men. Li Wen, what do you think is going on?
Yeah, frustrated middle-aged men is a very accurate summary of all these the characters of the killers here. As we noticed that it's within less than 2 months, 1.5 months, that the first killer in Nanping, Fujian province, has got three copycats following him. So obviously there's some kind of resentment in our society and they just burst out right now. So I think what we need right now is to look closer into these individual cases and have a public debate.
But why do you think this is happening? I mean, why are these men targeting children?
Basically, they don't have this mechanism stopping them from this violence against everybody.
They feel rootless.
Yeah, they feel rootless, yeah. And the other thing, of course, if that's the case, you choose the easy target.
Is there something in common with the targets other than elementary school kids? Are we talking, is it just what happens to be nearby? Is it a more privileged school in relative terms?
No. That's a misleading thought.
Right. Right.
Very misleading.
Right.
They could just choose anything. If you read one of these reports by Nanfang Renwu Zhoukan, and they have done this thorough research into this, and the first killer, actually has been, that's just a common school. He played with the kids before, and the kids all like him. He gave them, you know, candies or whatever.
Right. I just wanted to clarify that because there were some initial reports, and I agree with you. I think basically what the reason that kids are targeted is because it's
easy targets,
and it's not easy to get a gun as you would do in the United States.
Yeah.
If you did get a gun and go to a high school in the United States, or you would get shot, or even a middle school, by other kids. And here you can go into an elementary school and they're defenseless, they're not ready. It's just not something they're used to here.
I think there's more to it than just attacking defenseless targets. There's always a range of objectives when these kinds of things happen, and these people aren't attacking other people that they have personal connections with. I don't think they're attacking students just because they're defenseless. Attacking kids, there's a couple of things that happens. One is if you are trying to make a dent in the public consciousness, if you're trying to send a message to society, if you want your story to be told, you want to be noticed, you're going to attack a sensational target. And there's no target more sensational than children. And you can see now security arrangements are being changed. It's a widespread topic of conversation. The media is following it, reporting on it at length. So children are symbolic, not just easy. And you draw attention to yourself and to your story when you single out children to attack in a way that you don't, even if you go into a police station, as that man did in Shanghai now, last year. Was it last year?
A couple of years ago.
2008. Yeah. And so I think that's why the kids are getting – one reason why kids are getting –
That's one reason. But I do think that the difficulty in, let's say, getting firearms would be – would mean it kind of disqualifies a number of other possibilities. You know, in America we have workplace shootings. You know, that's sort of our version that seems to happen all the time.
And in Malaysia, Indonesia, you run amok with a parang, you know, a machete. Different societies have different pathologies when sort of people go off the bend. And we seem to have discovered one here for China.
Is there a reason why this is happening now?
I got a very interesting data today with regard to the payment.
Salaries.
Wages, salaries.
Basically takes up. In 2005, took up 36.7% of our GDP. And in 1983, it took up 56.5%, meaning in the past 20-something years, the salary has decreased.
Right. The worker's share of GDP has declined.
Yeah. And meanwhile, the capital gain has increased by 20%.
Right. And can't go to a Chinese city without nearly being run over by a Porsche SUV.
Exactly.
Bill Bishop, a frequent participant in this podcast, was pointing out today online that the Gini coefficient for China has now gone over 4, which he mentioned was widely accepted as a danger threshold.
The Gini coefficient being...
We already hit that.
The measurement of disparity between new threshold even further, even higher. And so it measures this disparity between the rich and the poor. And basically China has been for years already on par with the worst nations in the world, including the United States.
But then, of course, I mean, we can't just contribute everything to the wealth gap, I think. When I was writing the column this morning... Actually, this morning or last evening, I was thinking also about the education in China, because when you look back, out of 4 of these killers, 3 of them are actually relatively well educated in their generation. So they know everything. The first killer actually reads international, 环球时报, Global Times every day, and 参考消息, which is, you know, very high class reading in their generation. So I'm thinking, how come they resort to this? And then I think, look back to our education, and I found something even more alarming. Since our childhood, we were educated to believe that violence is the only useful method if you want to change the society. This is part of Marxism theory.
Right.
The gradual reform in Britain is considered to be not thorough enough. You know, this kind of way of thinking has been deeply rooted, especially in this generation, 40-something. But nowadays, maybe we have different point of view gradually because of the coming of different informations on the internet.
And the way China has actually changed gradually.
We start to have some sort of negotiation between the authority and the people, although it's still rather limited. But before, there wasn't any.
This is an interesting twist, of course, because, I mean, obviously every society looks for causes for this kind of behavior. And in the United States, the common target for blame is the mass media, the entertainment, video games, movies that have violence. That would be turning it a little bit on its head, too.
Well, we can blame the Americans, too. Everybody watched Hollywood pirated DVDs.
So. And you wouldn't be the first to blame us.
Right. Well, I'm sure you will see, as this kind of unfolds, you'll see more emphasis on those kinds of cultural factors than on the ones you just described.
Let's look at the state, the government response to this. I think, first of all, security-wise, there are now security measures, at least in places like Beijing, around schools, increased police presence. Bill Bishop, our frequent guest on this podcast, just called. He picked up his kids from school, and there were police there checking the security systems in place and installing panic buttons. Now, this is unlikely to be happening in remote villages or small towns, but certainly in the bigger cities, there is a beefed up security. On the other hand, the media, that's a different story. There hasn't been as much, nearly as much play of the story in the media as it would be if it was in a Western country. And it's quite obvious that the government is seeking to control the media coverage of this. I just want to ask if maybe this is not a good thing, in the sense that I once met a guy from the State Council Information Office who was talking about similar issues. And he said, in China, we don't want the pornography of violence that people have in the United States. And I could actually see his point of view in the sense that when you have a brutal murder, a school killing, 24-hour news is all over it, every single detail. It is very much like pornography.
Like in Germany, you don't put suicidal news on the top headlines because sociologists found out that actually it caused more people to follow suit.
It's actually a common feature of journalism not to really write about suicides as a news event. I mean, normal run-of-the-mill.
We really didn't expect that such a killing spree in kindergarten would bring out all these copycats. Never happened.
There is a point there in that, as philosophically inclined as Americans tend to be towards an unfettered media, there is an argument there for managing coverage of this kind of thing. There is a tendency in the public to believe that things that they witness, even in the media, are much more likely than they actually are. Statistically, what are the chances that the school where your kids go in China, this is a big country, is going to be, you know, is going to be subject to an attack? They're vanishingly, vanishingly remote. People see this all over the media. They really will believe it can happen to them. This is how it works. It's called the availability heuristic. If you witness something, even by abstraction, you believe it's much more common than it actually is. It talks to your little fear monkey. Airplane crashes, terrorist attacks, knife attacks on schools. So there is an argument for managing this. The question is there a point at which that will become counterproductive?
I think there's also one inherent problem. There's a cynicism about how the government manages the media here that might sort of make it less effective.
And people will also assume the worst motives, perhaps.
No, I think that the problem here is not that they put down the news to a less significant place, but more that they put down a public debate on this to a less significant place. I mean, this is a perfect chance for us to rediscover the topics about caring for the, you know, marginal groups. And like two out of these four killers, they were mentally ill. And nobody was taking care of them. And then about this social gap and about, you know, how we educate our kids and all these kind of thing. And we don't have thorough debate on this. One editorial and that's it.
Right. Nobody, and there's a balance to be struck. You know, if you air out the issues, you may have less resentment and pent-up resentment and more open discussion of issues that are important.
Exactly.
On the other hand, if you go to the other extreme, as we've seen in the West,
you get hysteria.
You get sensationalization and hysteria, and you get a panic. I think you already have some of that element here obviously the number of copycat killings, and it's kind of a question of whether this will just sort of subside pretty soon, and then maybe there'll be some discussion allowed, we can hope, you know, perhaps.
We'll try our best, but, you know, it's kind of difficult. Yeah.
What are people saying in China, Li Wen, about this? What is the ordinary person, the proverbial man on the street, what is he saying about this?
I think the first reaction normally is anger, because nobody has done this before. You get on an airplane and a baby cries, Europeans will complain, but Chinese will never, because they love children. So this kind of thing normally is a blow on Chinese head, that actually among our people, there are people who are so angry that they forget completely about our culture.
Is there a sort of recognition in that of the failings of the mental health system here, or, you know, or the kind of lack thereof?
Yes.
Of them?
Yes, there are. Actually, if you check out all the major portal websites in China, they all try to raise awareness on these topics. But for some reason, it's not really put on the significant place on their pages right now. So obviously, there is a kind of control there. So if such a kind of killing spree happened in the U.S., what kind of reaction would you get from the society?
Right. You do get the kind of discussion of the issues that you're talking about that you want to see, where people really discuss what the problems afflicting society are that would cause this kind of problem like the Columbine school killings. But you also get that amidst a sea, perhaps an overwhelming tidal wave of sensational coverage that's not quite as much light as heat, as they say. So you get a mix. But I think the overall effect is that these issues are aired out and people get, you know, on the negative side, maybe desensitized, but on the positive side, they are confronting them. And I'm reminded of a previous panic. I may be betraying my age a little bit here. In the maybe early 80s, the Tylenol scare was being an example of an overreaction created by, scared parents about, it's, you know, media attention, where there was, you know, a few spiked Tylenol capsules that killed a few people of cyanide. It led to, major safety overhaul that now lasts to this day that made those kinds of products tamper-proof. And there was a brief period of panic, and there was discussion about how this could happen, and then it passed. It's not the same as killing children in schools, but you hope that by airing these things out, having discussion, you have some sort of long-term solutions come out of things.
But
like
you
this.
Didn't have policemen posted all over the.
You would,
campus.
I'm sure, you would.
Well,
have,
in the U.S., you got metal detectors, and the method is different in the U.S. You get metal detectors in schools. You get pat downs in urban schools, more security guards. That's the same as here. The weapon worry in the U.S. is different. It's firearms. Yeah. In these kinds of situations in the U.S., I think also here, almost anywhere where it happens, often there's a problem in that people really want two things. They want to know who to blame, and they want often a simple solution, often a more simple solution than the actual root problem calls for. And this is where we sometimes get into an issue with attention span, certainly in the U.S., where there's pressure to solve problems, and what happens is you get solutions that are applied in a cursory way to provide the appearance of dealing with problems that are really very complex and very deep. You may be able to see that with our entire TSA apparatus, our airline security apparatus, which is sort of the result of that kind of thinking. And I think it happens in these situations as well. It's hard to sustain an intelligent discussion for a long time. People's attention tends to fade. And if the government wants to be seen to have addressed a problem, often it will be the result of that is putting in place something that's highly visible, even if it doesn't always get to the root of whatever the situation is. And the question I have about the situation here now is whether that's going to happen here. We're seeing the security guards at schools, at least here in Beijing, and we're seeing some of the fundamental steps to try to protect children. What you were talking about a few minutes ago, Li-Wen, this deeper debate about mental health and the root problems, how much attention will go to these much more complex aspects of the problem, that remains to be seen.
Will makes a very good point there. I think there is earnest discussion after these incidents in the United States and maybe less good follow-through, certainly in-depth follow-through. But you do see, I think, institutional responses that last, despite the fact that the institution may forget why they have the measures that they implemented. And I think you see counseling at schools, I'm sure, is pretty much omnipresent in U.S. schools.
And you do see vigorous debates about things like gun policy.
Which, unfortunately, is necessary at our schools in the U.S. But I think you do see both institutional responses, and then you see a little bit of a lack of institutional memory. And then, of course, you see that all of those measures are overwhelmed by the hard facts of life and of societal problems.
Is this really a new thing in China? I mean, Li-Wen, can you remember a similar space of crimes that sociopathic crimes?
Attacking children, no.
But would they have been covered in a public way in an earlier pre-internet, pre-text messaging era?
That's a good question. That's a very good question. I wouldn't know before the internet time.
I think now you have an obvious case of you can't cover up this news completely. That's why it's out at all, I think. If you tried to cover it up and then it got out by text messaging or blogs or whatever other method, there would be an outcry that had been covered up. And people would blame the center. And now you don't have that option. And I wonder, if there have been previous problems with violence or serial killers. I think it's it's pretty much established that there have been times where serial killer cases were,
yeah,
were not
killers,
covered
yes. A lot.
In the 80s often and 90s.
They are reported after the killer
right,
was caught.
Right, after they've been arrested.
Yeah.
But of course they're not all caught.
Yeah.
And then the cases of serial murders then go unreported and we have no idea.
So then is this possibly a case of it's not something new? Our reasoning about the Gini coefficient, the stresses on society, maybe that's flawed. Maybe this has been going on, you know, for years in China. It's just that we know about it now. Is that likely?
That's likely, but to my knowledge, I never heard of any. So, I mean, even if someone who like to discover the historical facts from the internet about the past, I haven't heard of any.
It would be very interesting to know. This thing we were talking about earlier, the fact that different societies have different pathologies, it would be interesting to know if this is a long-standing social pathology or something that really has emerged now. I talked briefly before about ethnic malaise and running amok, you know, this idea that when the stress finally becomes too much in the village, you get a parang and you hack up your neighbors. And
we have that word in English, in fact,
yeah,
from the Malay.
It made such a big impression on the English that it was sucked into the English language to run amok, you know, to go crazy. And it's a shame that it's hard to dig into the history of this issue and find out if it's something that has been going on for a while. That would be very interesting to know, and I think it would inform the public's reaction to this as an issue.
Right. We obviously don't have a full data set, and you can't in this sort of system. I would be a little surprised if you'd had a spate like this before because part of this, of course, was generated. Certainly there was a copycat element to this that would be impossible under a system where you don't find out about any of this.
I would say so too. But what I'm thinking is more about the, if you look into these four cases, the killers all resemble each other. This is such a obvious fact. Mental illness, jobless, frustrated men.
And you think we'll see more of this as, you know, this famous gender gap gets worse in the kind of generation ahead?
That could be also, like when the first killer also was dumped by his girlfriend, the frustrations.
Well, this has been the great kind of demographic fear,
yeah.
Is that this, we have this gap of, I don't know, I forget the numbers, 20 million.
We are resigning into doing nothing.
Right. And clearly society needs to address this. The government and society needs to address this issue facing it. But
the worry is that they won't. And the solution will be let's visibly protect schools in a way that parents can see. So
especially
they
de-stress, in rich cities.
Especially in rich cities. You cannot protect every school in this country. There's too many.
Right. But the larger issue of, you know, if you have a lot of men who are going to be behaving badly.
You're going to have some
serious
problems.
Of course, what you'll have is probably the American solution of locking them all up.
When speaking about gender issues, I mean, maybe it's also worth bringing up the fact that China is apparently has the highest female suicide rate in the world. So it's not just the men who are unhappy.
Yeah, but women tend to kill themselves, you know,
rather than killing
others. So we are less of a threat. But yeah, that's a very serious issue, actually. We do have some NGOs helping women from committing suicide, getting out of their difficult situations, but it's far from enough. And this is another topic that actually should be brought up. Like the NGOs in China, they are so restricted that basically people are stopped from helping themselves,
right,
helping each other.
And in the United States, that's a good point. The United States sort of decimated its sort of government-run mental health sort of system in the 80s and it's been replaced to the degree that it has been replaced by a lot of kind of the equivalent of NGOs and nonprofits, volunteer clinics have done a lot to help fill the gap. And here perhaps it will be more difficult for that to...
Very difficult, especially, I mean, you get everything in big cities, right? Like these NGOs helping poor women. But, I mean, there are more women in need in the countryside. If they want to get help, they have to come to Beijing.
And culturally, is there an obstacle to developing mental health as something, as a real option?
As well, yeah. I mean, news about mentally ill people killing their families or their neighbors are all over the place. And that you can see from time to time from the news. But still, there's no real reaction, big changes in the government policy to improve this situation.
Let's finish off this podcast with a related but different subject. There's been a story going the rounds of the internet recently that the number of people infected with syphilis and babies born with syphilis in China has been growing exponentially over the last few years. Now, this is a very funny thing because syphilis is an easy disease to prevent and cure. What is behind this problem?
About the babies, I have a good explanation that China gave up, I think, 2 years ago, obligatory premarital body check. Before then, we had that. Everybody had to check.
A health examination before you got married.
But now, 2 years ago, I think, they gave up on that. Like, it's not obligatory anymore. So lots of, not just syphilis, many other diseases, like not disease or maybe genetic problems come out. So our babies are getting less healthier nowadays compared with 2 years ago.
Whereas before, if you had syphilis when you were married, then
you would be found out and you would cure it. Yeah. But then on the other hand, like why adults get syphilis, it's because the sex education is basically not there. Online pornography has taken over the role of sex education of the government.
And so, pornography generally doesn't do a very good job on telling you how to have safe sex.
Yeah.
No, but it may help you figure out how to work with the animals more creatively. You can edit that out if you want to.
I wouldn't know from experience,
but that's what I hear. Well, Daddy told me.
Just to be clear, that was Will Moss.
I don't think we will edit that out, Mr. William Moss.
Well, I'm in trouble now, then.
Yeah, I mean, fantasies, but you have to know that's fantasy. It's not real.
Right. I mean, there's clearly a huge gap in sex education. This has been the problem with controlling the spread of HIV, I mean, which they were even denying was a problem until, you know, early in the last decade. And
so why is China so bad at sex education? I mean, one of my first experiences in China was when I was first here. I lived in a workers' dormitory and I had to use the public toilet that we all used, which was one of those ones that had no borders or dividers between the different squat toilets.
Please give us a graphic display of this.
I'm imagining it already.
Yeah, you'll have to imagine it. And I was amazed by how comfortable Chinese people seem to be with their own bodies. It seems to me there's no reason for sex education to be taboo or difficult in this country. People are very comfortable with their physicality. Why is it such a problem?
Pleasure is different from naked bodies. Pleasure is treated as sex pleasure, treated as something always a little bit negative.
That contradiction doesn't surprise me. Sex is a taboo in public discourse, and education is a pretty widespread problem. And the issue of having effective sex education is pretty widespread. We definitely suffer from it in the U.S., although we perhaps have a more conservative streak when it comes to body issues than you have here. But that's always a tough one to wrestle with, and it doesn't surprise me that it's tough here.
Right. And once again, non-institutional sort of forces in the United States, I think, were probably key in kind of advancing sex education in the United States, especially with the HIV and AIDS problem in the 80s and 90s. And you had, a massive public education effort.
And these things are also always difficult if they're tied up with national image issues. That was certainly a case with AIDS, not just here, but in many places. And if it's the case with a syphilis outbreak as well, then you may see some of the same problems in place. If there are worries that it's going to be an image problem for the nation or for some aspect of the government, then there's going to be problems in instituting a really effective response.
You also have to consider that public health reporting and monitoring, especially in areas where there might be illegal activity like prostitution, you run into problems of trust issues with the government.
Prostitution is illegal in China?
Right. Technically illegal. But you run into problems of trust issues with the various, you have the health ministry, of course, I think very well-meaning in its attempts to kind of do outreach. But then you run up against the public security ministry. You run up against other kind of perhaps less enlightened or with government agencies with different interests. And you have
the usual problems with enforcement that affect so many well-meaning programs here.
But you have a lot of people who aren't going to maybe necessarily the first thing they're not going to turn to
an institution for help or a test or...
The urge, the constant urge of the government to go back to the omnipresent, omni-capable time in the revolutionary times, this urge is actually very dangerous when it comes to the topic that we are talking about, that they intervene into your sex life. And because of that, they just, you know, come up with one idea, okay, sex is shameful, and then, okay, nobody can talk about it on the media or whatever. And then nobody can deal out condoms to the prostitutes because they are illegal and blah, blah, blah. So all these kind of, this urge to control an individual's life, I think, is in the way. It's a big obstacle.
But this is interesting, and it goes back to the issue of the mental health problems and the school stabbings as well. You can take an interventionist approach to dealing with these kind of problems, or you can take a reactive approach where you allow people to come to you for help. Will a reactive approach work? Will it work in this society? Will the kind of people who are likely to go off their trees and go into a kindergarten with a knife voluntarily seek out mental health services, or do you have to intervene? And for a sexually transmitted disease in this culture, will people voluntarily seek out help, or do you have to intervene even if it's in a way as delicate as requiring health checkups before marriage?
That was the wrong restriction to lift. Yeah. Maybe they could have lifted the restrictions, say, on the media. Instead,
or how about that rule that makes me have to go in and register every time I come back into the country? That would be a good one.
We'll do a whole podcast on that.
Would
one
we?
Well, for
that
you.
Would be good. Ask me about the trip I took to the Haituswil with my father recently.
On that note, before we get anyone arrested at the Seneca Studio,
thank you. Most likely me.
Thank you very much, Will.
That's
thank
Will Moss.
That's Will Moss. Arrest him first. Thank you, Chinli Wen and Gadi. As always, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.